Chapter 19. Up, groats around to see that the children are safe, and puts them under a shed out of the rain. If the palace burns down, you take shelter in the barn. What man's life is not overtaken by one or more of these tornadoes that send us out of the course and fling us on rocks to shelter as best we may? When Lady Castlewood found that her great ship had gone down, she began as best she might after as he had rallied from the effects of the loss, to put out small ventures of happiness, and hope for little gains and returns, as a merchant on change, Indocilus Pauperium Potty, having lost his thousands, embarks a few guineas upon the next ship. She laid out her all upon her children, indulging them beyond all measure, as was inevitable with one of her kindness of disposition, giving all her thoughts to their welfare, learning that she might teach them, and improving her own many natural gifts and feminine accomplishments, that she might impart them to her young ones. To be doing good for someone else is the life of most good women. They are exuberant of kindness, as it were, and must impart it to someone. She made herself a good scholar of French, Italian, and Latin, having been grounded in these by her father in her youth, hiding these gifts from her husband out of fear, perhaps, that they should offend him, for my lord was no bookman pishit and saw it at the notion of learned ladies, and would have been angry that his wife could construe out of a Latin book, of which he could scarce understand two words. Young Esmond was usher, or house tutor, under her or over her, as it might happen. During my lord's many absences, these school days would go on uninterruptedly. The mother and daughter learning with surprising quickness, the latter by fits and starts only, and as suited her wayward humor. As for the little lord, it must be owned that he took after his father in the matter of learning like marbles and play, and the great horse and the little one which his father brought him, and on which he took him out a hunting, a great deal better than Cordelius and Lily, marshaled the village boys, and had a little court of them, already flogging them, and domineering over them with a fine imperious spirit, that made his father laugh when he beheld it, and his mother fondly warn him. The cook had a son, the woodman had two, the big lad at the porter's lodge took his cuffs and his orders. Dr. Tusher said he was a young nobleman of gallant spirit, and Harry Esmond, who was his tutor, and 8 years his little lordship's senior, had hard work sometimes, to keep his own temper, and hold his authority over his rebellious little chief and kinsman. In a couple of years after that calamity had befallen which had robbed Lady Castlewood of a very little of her beauty, and her careless husband's heart, if the truth must be told, my lady had found not only that her reign was over, but that her successor was appointed, a princess of a noble house in Drury Lane somewhere, who was installed and visited by my lord at the town 8 miles off Putatica Probria Dissier Nobis. A great change had taken place in her mind, which, by struggles only known to herself, at least never mentioned to anyone, and unsuspected by the person who caused the pain she endured, had been schooled into such a condition as she could not very likely have imagined possible a score of months since, before her misfortunes had begun. As he had oldened in that time as people do who suffer silently great mental pain, and learned much that as he had never suspected before, she was taught by that bitter teacher misfortune. A child the mother of other children, but 2 years back her lord was a god to her, his words her law, his smile her sunshine, his lazy commonplaces listened to eagerly, as if they were words of wisdom, all his wishes and freaks obeyed with a servile devotion. As he had been my lord's chief slave and blind worshipper, some women bear farther than this, and submit not only to neglect, but to unfaithfulness too, but here this lady's allegiance had failed her. Her spirit rebelled, and disowned any more obedience. First she had to bear in secret the passion of losing the adored object, then to get further initiation, and to find this worshipped being was but a clumsy idol, then to admit the silent truth, that it was she was superior, and not the monarch her master, that as he had thoughts which his brains could never master, and was the better of the two, quite separate from my lord, although tied to him and bound, as almost all people save a very happy few, to work all her life alone. My lord sat in his chair, laughing his laugh, cracking his joke, his face flushing with wine, my lady in her place over against him, he never suspecting that his superior was there, in the calm resigned lady, cold of manner, with downcast eyes. When he was merry in his cups, he would make jokes about her coldness, and, be it, now my lady is gone, we will have t'other bottle, he would say. He was frank enough in telling his thoughts, such as they were. There was little mystery about my lord's words or actions. His fair Rosamond did not live in a labyrinth, like the lady of Mr. Addison's opera, but paraded with painted cheeks and a tipsy retinue in the country town. Had she a mind to be revenged, Lady Castlewood could have found the way to her rival's house easily enough, and, if as he had come with bowl and dagger, would have been routed off the ground by the enemy with a volley of Billingsgate, which the fair person always kept by her. Meanwhile, it has been said, that for Harry Esmond his benefactress's sweet face had lost none of its charms. It had always the kindest of looks and smiles for him, smiles, not so gay and artless perhaps as those which Lady Castlewood had formerly worn, when, a child herself, playing with her children, her husband's pleasure and authority were all she thought of. But out of her griefs and cares, as will happen I think when these trials fall upon a kindly heart, and are not too unbearable, grew up a number of thoughts and excellences which had never come into existence, had not her sorrow and misfortunes engendered them. Sure, occasion is the father of most that is good in us. As you have seen the awkward fingers and clumsy tools of a prisoner cut and fashion the most delicate little pieces of carved work, or achieve the most prodigious underground labors, and cut through walls of masonry, and saw iron bars and fetters, 'tis misfortune that awakens ingenuity, or fortitude, or endurance, in hearts where these qualities had never come to life, but for the circumstance which gave them a being. 'Twas after Jason left her, no doubt, Lady Castlewood once said with one of her smiles to young Esmond, who was reading to her a version of certain lines out of Euripides, that Medea became a learned woman and a great enchantress. And she could conjure the stars out of heaven, the young tutor added, but she could not bring Jason back again. What do you mean? Asked my lady, very angry. Indeed I mean nothing, said the other, save what I've read in books. What should I know about such matters? I have seen no woman save you and little Beatrix, and the parson's wife and my late mistress, and your ladyship's woman here. The men who wrote your books, says my lady, your Horace's, and Ovid's, and Virgil's, as far as I know of them, all thought ill of us, as all the heroes they wrote about used us basely. We were bred to be slaves always. And even of our own times, as you are still the only lawgivers, I think our sermons seem to say that the best woman is she who bears her master's chains most gracefully. 'Tis a pity there are no nunneries permitted by our church. Beatrix and I would fly to one, and end our days in peace there away from you. And is there no slavery in a convent? Says Esmond. At least if women are slaves there, no one sees them, answered the lady. They don't work in street gangs with the public to jeer them. And if they suffer, suffer in private. Here comes my lord home from hunting. Take away the books. My lord does not love to see them. Lessons are over for today, Mr. Tudor. And with a curtsy and a smile she would end this sort of colloquy. Indeed, Mr. Tudor, as my lady called Esmond, had now business enough on his hands in Castlewood House. He had three pupils, his lady and her two children, at whose lessons she would always be present, besides writing my lord's letters, and arranging his accompts for him, when these could be got from Esmond's indolent patron. Of the pupils the two young people were but lazy scholars, and as my lady would admit no discipline such as was then in use, my lord's son only learned what he liked, which was but little, and never to his life's end could be got to construe more than six lines of Virgil. Mistress Beatrix chattered French prettily, from a very early age, and sang sweetly, but this was from her mother's teaching, not Harry Esmond's, who could scarce distinguish between green sleeves and a libelero, although he had no greater delight in life than to hear the ladies sing. He sees them now, will he ever forget them? As they used to sit together of the summer evenings, the two golden heads over the page, the child's little hand, and the mother's beating the time, with their voices rising and falling in unison. But if the children were careless, 'twas a wonder how eagerly the mother learnt from her young tutor, and taught them to. The happiest instinctive faculty was this lady's, a faculty for discerning latent beauties and hidden graces of books, especially books of poetry, as in a walk she would spy out field flowers and make posies of them, such as no other hand could. She was a critic, not by reason but by feeling, the sweetest commentator of those books they read together. And the happiest hours of young Esmond's life, perhaps, were those passed in the company of this kind mistress and her children. These happy days were to end soon, however, and it was by the Lady Castlewood's own decree that they were brought to a conclusion. It happened about Christmas time, Harry Esmond being now past 16 years of age, that his old comrade, adversary, and friend, Tom Tusher, returned from his school in London, a fair, well-grown, and sturdy lad, who was about to enter college, with an exhibition from his school, and a prospect of after promotion in the church. Tom Tusher's talk was of nothing but Cambridge now, and the boys, who were good friends, examined each other eagerly about their progress in books. Tom had learned some Greek and Hebrew, besides Latin, in which he was pretty well skilled, and also had given himself to mathematical studies under his father's guidance, who was a proficient in those sciences, of which Esmond knew nothing, nor could he write Latin so well as Tom, though he could talk it better, having been taught by his dear friend the Jesuit father, for whose memory the lad ever retained the warmest affection, reading his books, keeping his swords clean in the little crypt, where the father had shown them to Esmond on the night of his visit, and often of a night sitting in the chaplain's room, which he inhabited, over his books, his verses, and rubbish, with which the lad occupied himself, he would look up at the window, thinking he wished it might open and let in the good father. He had come, and passed away like a dream. But for the swords and books, Harry might almost think the father was an imagination of his mind, and for two letters which had come to him, one from abroad, full of advice and affection, another soon after he had been confirmed by the Bishop of Hexton, in which Father Holt deplored his falling away. But Harry Esmond felt so confident now of his being in the right, and of his own powers as a casuist, that he thought he was able to face the father himself in argument, and possibly convert him. To work upon the faith of her young pupil, Esmond's kind mistress sent to the library of her father the dean, who had been distinguished in the disputes of the late king's reign, and, an old soldier now, had hung up his weapons of controversy. These he took down from his shelves willingly for young Esmond, whom he benefited by his own personal advice and instruction. It did not require much persuasion to induce the boy to worship with his beloved mistress, and the good old nonjuring dean flattered himself with a conversion which, in truth, was owing to a much gentler and fairer persuader. Under her ladyship's kind eyes, my lord's being sealed in sleep pretty generally, Esmond read many volumes of the works of the famous British divines of the last age, and was familiar with Wake and Sherlock, with Stillingfleet and Patrick. His mistress never tired to listen or to read, to pursue the texts with fond comments, to urge those points which her fancy dwelt on most, or her reason deemed most important. Since the death of her father the dean, this lady hath admitted a certain latitude of theological reading which her orthodox father would never have allowed, his favorite writers appealing more to reason and antiquity than to the passions or imaginations of their readers, so that the works of Bishop Taylor, nay, those of Mr. Baxter and Mr. Law, have in reality found more favor with my Lady Castlewood than the severer volumes of our great English schoolmen. In later life, At the university, Esmond reopened the controversy and pursued it in a very different manner when his patrons had determined for him that he was to embrace the ecclesiastical life. But though his mistress's heart was in his calling, his own never was much. After that first fervor of simple devotion, which his beloved Jesuit priest had inspired in him, speculative theology took but little hold upon the young man's mind. When his early credulity was disturbed, and his saints and virgins taken out of his worship, to rank little higher than the divinities of Olympus, his belief became acquiescence rather than ardor, and he made his mind up to assume the cassock and bands, as another man does to wear a breastplate and jackboots, or to mount a merchant's desk, for a livelihood, and from obedience and necessity, rather than from choice. There were scores of such men in Mr. Esmond's time at the universities, who were going to the church with no better calling than his. When Thomas Tusher was gone, a feeling of no small depression and disquiet fell upon young Esmond, of which, though he did not complain, his kind mistress must have divined the cause. For soon after she showed, not only that she understood the reason of Harry's melancholy, but could provide a remedy for it. Her habit was thus to watch, unobservedly, those to whom duty or affection bound her, and to prevent their designs, or to fulfill them, whenas he had the power. It was this lady's disposition to think kindnesses, and devise silent bounties, and to scheme benevolence, for those about her. We take such goodness, for the most part, as if it was our due. The Marys who bring ointment for our feet get but little thanks. Some of us never feel this devotion at all, or are moved by it to gratitude or acknowledgement. Others only recall it years after, when the days are past in which those sweet kindnesses were spent on us, and we offer back our return for the debt by a poor tardy payment of tears. Then forgotten tones of love recur to us, and kind glances shine out of the past oh so bright and clear, oh so longed after, because they are out of reach. As holiday music from withinside a prison wall or sunshine seen through the bars, more prized because unattainable, more bright, because of the contrast of present darkness and solitude, whence there is no escape. All the notice, then, which Lady Castlewood seemed to take of Harry Esmond's melancholy, upon Tom Tusher's departure, was, by a gaiety unusual to her, to attempt to dispel his gloom. She made his three scholars, herself being the chief one, more cheerful than ever they had been before, and more docile too, all of them learning and reading much more than they had been accustomed to do. "Or who knows," said the lady, "what may happen, and whether we may be able to keep such a learned tutor long." Frank Esmond said he for his part did not want to learn any more, and Cousin Harry might shut up his book whenever he liked, if he would come out a fishing. And little Beatrix declared she would send for Tom Tusher, and he would be glad enough to come to Castlewood, if Harry chose to go away. At last comes a messenger from Winchester one day, bearer of a letter, with a great black seal, from the dean there, to say that his sister was dead, and had left her fortune of 2,000 l. Among her six nieces, the dean's daughters. And many a time since has Harry Esmond recalled the flushed face and eager look wherewith, after this intelligence, his kind lady regarded him. She did not pretend to any grief about the deceased relative, from whom she and her family had been many years parted. When my lord heard of the news, he also did not make any very long face. He money will come very handy to furnish the music room and the cellar, which is getting low, and buy your ladyship a coach and a couple of horses, that will do indifferent to ride, or for the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.